Some of our beloved listeners give to us, and it's much needed. I mean, goodness me, we're so grateful for that.
Very kind of them.
Oh, it's wonderful. But I was thinking it'd be nice to do something special with that money.
Yeah.
So something we can really remember them by, but also something useful that would sort of bring a bit of security to us.
Mm.
And so I was wondering whether we could buy Greenland. I mean, it's for sale.
Apparently there's a bidding war going on. Do you think we've got enough for Greenland? I mean, I think we've basically got enough just to go for a shop in Iceland. I don't think we've got enough for Greenland.
I don't know. I didn't know how much it was. I mean, it can't be much, can it?
Well, it's not much there, is there?
No. I would hope there's change from a few hundred quid, wouldn't there be?
Well, maybe we should set our sights slightly lower. Okay. What about the Isle of Wight? How about that?
Yes, that's perfect. Let's get that.
Welcome, everybody, to episode 314 of the Midfaith Crisis podcast. My name is... I laugh there because you were sort of sitting back in a kind of smug thing, almost waiting for something to happen, and it was a self-fulfilling prophecy.
No, I'm not. I'm still laughing at what a great time it is to be a megalomaniac at the moment.
Okay.
That's all.
It's a boom time for them.
It is a boom time.
My name's Nick Page. This is the Midfaith Crisis podcast. I've lost completely where I am.
Yeah.
And there's Joe Davis.
Hello. It doesn't really matter that it's episode 340. No. None of that matters. Yeah, I'll tell you something before you say, are there any church notices? No, there aren't. The Enneagram Day is full. In fact, we have a waiting list now.
Really?
Here's something I've learnt about fours. You do tend to leave it last minute.
Yeah. Yeah, you think? Yeah.
So
how long have you known me?
I'm not sure I did really know that about you, actually. But it's all good. Anyway, how are you, dear boy?
Yeah, I'm good. I've been watching some very long films.
Have you?
Yeah, because I think this is where the film industry are not helping themselves, if I'm honest. Because if they want me to go to the cinema and to pay an enormous amount of money for it, making a three-hour film, it's not going to work because I'm just going to want to go to the toilet too many times in it.
You're a man of a certain age.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So they're not actually helping their product, I don't think. Anyway, so I've been watching films at home, if they're that long. Yeah. And I've watched Wicked. That was very good.
Did you watch that at home?
Yes. It's just come out. We had my daughter, being a mad keen musicals fan, we had to buy it. But it's great. Loved it. That's really good.
Okay.
And then I just watched, the last couple of nights, I watched Dune 1 and Dune 2.
Yes. Not seen them. Any good?
Very, very good. Very, fantastic sort of world shaping. But I do have a question.
Yeah.
Why is it everyone in the future, in space, still fights with a sword?
I don't know. You'd think they'd have better stuff now, wouldn't you?
In Dune, they have these great big cannons and lasers and things like that, but they still actually do hand-to-hand combat with a sword. And you're thinking, just shoot the guy. Why are you having that? That's just stupid. Anyway, and apart from that, I've been trying to keep warm in this very cold weather, largely by chopping wood
very good.
For the fire.
You're a lumberjack. And you're okay?
I'm very okay. It's been cold, hasn't it?
Yes, it has been.
But beautiful, much like myself.
Yes, indeed. Yeah, can't argue with that.
No. And anyway, that's me. How are you?
Yeah, okay. This week was the anniversary of my brother's death, so I've been very mindful of that, chatting to my sister-in-law in Mexico. And it's been cold, and it's January. And although I do love sun, and it is sunny now, I am definitely solar powered. I cannot abide the grey days. That's something that's definitely getting worse the older I get. Work's very busy. I tell you what I've been enjoying. I've been enjoying very much the daily Richard Rohr emails this year because I lost a bit of track with them last year. But this year's theme is Salt and Light. In fact, I copied a bit because I thought you would like this. And this is just from one of the ones earlier in the week. And he says, in Matthew's gospel, Jesus tells us to be salt. Not the meat, the potatoes, or even the vegetables, just the invisible but very effective salt. Salt is what gives zing and taste to food, and Jesus is calling us to be people who give purpose, meaning, and desire to life. Either we learn how to be the salt of the earth, a true alternative to the normal motivations and actions of society, or as Jesus put it very clearly, we might as well be thrown out and trampled underfoot. We have to find our inner authority through Christ in us. We have to find our purpose in our love of God and neighbour and actions of mercy and justice. Otherwise, we're not offering anything that the world doesn't already have or can't find in other places. And that's a fairly good summary of what they're kind of going to be covering in the year ahead. And I thought, you know, last week we talked about purposes and things like that. And I just thought, yeah, that's we're still up for that, I think.
Yeah, I love that. And that's interesting, isn't it? Because so many of the metaphors Jesus uses are small, barely visible things. Yeast, you know, the mustard seed, salt. So even light, you know, you can't really quantify it, can you? It comes quietly. It's not a sort of mass thing. It doesn't have a weight to it. So, yeah, I really enjoyed that. Thank you.
No, it's great. And listen, thank you to everyone who wrote in just saying, oh, it was nice to hear the podcast and you appreciated what we talked about last week. Although there was not much feedback, as in people wanting to argue, dispute, say their own findings. So this week we've got the chance to catch up on some of the emails we've been saving forever. So like I say, we will get around to it eventually. And so we're going to do that. Should we do that now?
Well, it might as well. No time like the present.
Okay. So Steve wrote this. Hi, guys. Any thoughts about how to read the Bible, particularly Paul's letters, without it making my heart sink? I was listening to our pastor preaching for 1 Thessalonians 5 yesterday, bearing in mind that wasn't yesterday, that was probably some months ago, minding my own business when my eyes scanned across the page to 2 Thessalonians 1, and in particular verses 8 and 9. He will punish those who do not know God and do not obey the gospel of our Lord Jesus. They will be punished with everlasting destruction and shut out from the presence of the Lord and from the glory of his might. He says, I have been quite encouraged by the thoughts of Rob Bell and Steve Chalk, but it seems that dealing with messages of wrath and punishment for those who simply don't get God is like playing biblical whack-a-mole. You think one passage has been explained in a different light, then several other passages pop up in its place. It's so disheartening and not the encouraging, uplifting, transformative experience that reading the Bible should be. Also, my understanding is that we can't know God unless he reveals himself to us. Apologies for the pronouns, Joe. Accepted. Which makes these verses seem even harsher. I just don't know what to do with verses like these, which take me back to an image of God as one who is vengeful and full of wrath, and not the God of undefeatable love that I was beginning to believe existed. Any thoughts would be greatly appreciated. Thanks. And that's from Steve. And before we get into that one, can I just read this one from Andy as well?
That
all right? So we are definitely coming back to you, Steve. But Andy said this. Hi, Joe. Greetings, Happy New Year, and our heartfelt thanks for your and Nick's regular blessing to so many. He said, just returned from the gym where I listened to last week's podcast 313 and felt inspired to drop you a line. And he says, spoiler alert, compliment to Nick follows. So you might want to cover your ears or something. He says, Janet and I meet regularly with 2 good friends and call ourselves the Happy Doubters. I love that. That's great. He says, we've worked our way through Brian McLaren's Faith After Doubt, then Steve Chalk's Lost Message of Paul, and now we are enjoying Nick's Badly Behaved Bible. Last night we discussed chapter 7, The Joy of Doubt. Please pass our thanks to Nick for one of the best and most helpful chapters of insight. He is good. We found the discussion of if there is only one God, then who can we blame for the bad stuff so helpful, and suspect that most Alpha courses fall into the category of groups where there is a right conclusion, right in inverted commas. So we welcome Nick's idea of an Omega course where the object is to provide a safe space for doubts and questions and go where they take us without a predetermined outcome. We are in the happy position of keeping our Baptist Church minister informed of our thinking and enjoying his approval. Just wondering if any other listeners have worked to develop ideas for an Omega course. He says, bless you both and keep it going. And that's Randy.
Thank you very much, Andy. That's very kind of you.
Yeah.
I'm glad you found it helpful.
That is good. Well, so here's my first tip in answer to Steve's email now, which we need to go back to. And the first is buy the Badly Behaved Bible. It's superb book. Clearly one of Amazon's top bestsellers, I would imagine. I don't know that for a fact. I'm just assuming.
It's me and Richard Osman, I think, together.
Yeah,
really.
Yeah, that's right. Dominating the Amazon chart.
I mean, if that were the case, would I still be doing this? I don't know.
Yes, you would. You know you would. Seriously, I mean, you know, you would expect me to plug the book, but it's a fantastic book for anyone who is sort of struggling with Bible reading. I can say this in a way that you would just shrivel and wither away.
Okay.
The other tip I have, by the way, before we get into this, since you have written quite extensively on the subject of how to read the Bible, is I would encourage everyone to do as I did once when I was in a similar place struggling with Paul's letters and read them in the Message version. The Message, which, of course, most people know is not an actual translation. It's a paraphrase. And so much work has been done to actually get the meaning of it right. It makes a lot more sense in my mind. Mm. Yeah.
OK, well, yeah, great. I mean, thank you for all that. One of the conclusions of the Badly Behaved Bible is, you know, there are always going to be these bits that you don't get.
Yes.
I suppose with this passage, before we sort of delve into it, I'd want to say just a couple of things to start with. One, there's loads of stuff in Paul that is difficult for us in various ways, and I think that's partly because of the character he was and partly because of his mindset as well. But we shouldn't forget there's loads in Paul that is absolutely wonderful.
Yes, indeed.
And you know, has some really great bits. So I don't think we should tar all of his writing or characterize him as this kind of person, because who just deals with wrath and sort of telling people off and getting angry at people. So I'd want to say that. And I suppose the thing is, to start with, this is one of the most difficult passages, I think, certainly for people who are universalists.
Mm.
In other words, people who believe ultimately everyone will be saved. This is possibly the most nuggety, difficult sort of passage for that. And so what I'm going to say about it relies heavily on the interpretation from Gregory MacDonald in The Evangelical Universalist.
Okay, yeah.
Which is a book I thoroughly recommend. Gregory MacDonald, not his real name. I don't know if it's come out under his real name now. I think it might have. Anyway, and he talks about this as the most difficult passage. So the key verses in this passage are 8 and 9, particularly verse 9.
Yeah.
Which is in the NOSV goes, these people will suffer the punishment of eternal destruction, separated from the presence of the Lord and from the glory of his might.
Nice.
So it seems clearly to imply an eternal wrathiness, basically.
Yes, it does. Yeah.
Ongoing wrathiness. The context of this, though, is Paul is talking about, Paul's overall context is Jewish, very Jewish. There's going to be the day of the Lord. So the present age will be finished and the present world will be finished and a new age will be ushered in. So we have to sort of bear that in mind. There's a very sort of Jewish background, what's it called, eschatological background to this. So when you actually look at it, it's not quite as unambiguous as it seems, though, as is so much the case with these passages. One of the ways I think initially to respond to passages like this is to remind yourself that actually it's an ancient language, and quite often there are nuances in there, there's interpretation in there that might not be in the original. So looking at the Greek of this, the Greek text just says they will be punished with eternal destruction from the presence of the Lord. It doesn't say separated or set apart from. It could imply that eternal destruction, we're still going to deal with that bit, but is coming from God. He's actually doing something.
Yeah.
And I ought to point out as well, it's not just God in this passage who's doing this mighty bit, it's also Jesus.
Yes.
In verse 8, I think. Hang on, I put my Bible. I don't know if you recognise this. This is called a Bible, Joe. Have you seen these?
It seems familiar, yeah.
Big leather-bound thing.
So rude.
I'm just padding because I've lost the place. In verse 8, it's Jesus who sort of runs around with flaming fire. Lord Jesus is revealed from heaven with his mighty angels in flaming fire, inflicting vengeance on those who do not know God.
Nice.
Once again, you know, use a gun. You know, this is sci-fi.
Yes, but stop with the flaming. Yeah.
Why are you riding around doing it? Just press a button. So you know, we can't even just sort of separate this out saying, you know, God's doing the bad cop stuff and Jesus is good cop. Quite clearly,
they're both enjoying themselves now.
They are
getting on with the rothiness.
In Paul's understanding, it's both. So what's happening here? Well, again, the Greek is tricky because the Greek for eternal destruction.
And good luck pronouncing this.
Well, it's alethron ionion.
Ionion?
Ionion, A-I onion, which is presumably a self-aware onion. I'm not sure. I don't know. It's an onion.
Trying to avoid them.
You could ask questions of this onion and it will give you imperfect answers.
It's like Alexa.
So alethron means destruction, but it can also mean ruin.
Yeah.
And the ionion is sort of eternal, really. Or without a time boundary. But it's possible what Paul is talking about is this age is coming to an end. So the thing that's being destroyed is the ruin of the age is what he's actually talking about. So I think quite clearly he's saying in this passage, these people will get what's coming to them in the ruin of this age, when this age is bound up. And he's pointing out, and this is a quote, actually a quote from the Evangelical Universalist book. He says Paul is simply pointing out that those who have persecuted the Christians will not get away with it, but will be punished at the appearing of the Lord.
Yeah, and isn't that like the sort? Isn't that in the great tradition of sort of prophecy? Like, if you go on in this way, here's where it's all going to end in the end. It's not going to be good. It's not going to be pretty. And then prophecy, you've talked about this before, is not always about predicting the future. It's about saying there is an inevitable outcome to the way you're going, and this is what it's going to be.
And so I think that doesn't necessarily resolve, well, it doesn't resolve some of the issues at all, but it does show there's more nuance to it, perhaps, than is often presented. Having said that, the other thing that strikes me straight away is, if Jesus is involved, does this sound particularly Jesus-like?
Yeah, that's a really interesting perspective. Yeah. No,
because
it doesn't.
No, it doesn't really.
It doesn't. Not at all.
I mean, even on the basic thing of Jesus sort of romping around with a load of angels smiting people, that's not really how he is in the Gospels. And in fact, he talks against that.
Yes.
You know, when the disciples say, should we call down fire on this place who hasn't welcomed us? He doesn't say, don't worry, in the age to come, I'll ride over them
flame
with a load
them.
Of angels.
Yeah.
I will flame them.
I'll flame them.
Yeah.
Flambade.
They will be severely caramelized in the forthcoming age. And he doesn't say about taking vengeance. He says the very opposite.
Yeah.
You know, he says, forgive your enemies. Don't take revenge. So I think we have to accept what's happening is some picture language, some language of Jewish eschatology that's going on. That are involved in sort of wrapping up the end of the age.
Can I just ask you a question? Is part of the problem with this, because we have these passages that talk about all scripture is inspired and we have these deeply held evangelical convictions that this is the mighty word of God that is unchanging and everything, rather than seeing the Bible as I do now, which is a human book written by humans for other humans, that is discussing how they understand the divine, and that actually the divine does definitely emerge from those pages, but through the humanity of the people who are having the discussion. And when we read the Bible, we're drawn into that discussion. And certainly that's my understanding of sort of how the rabbis in the Jewish tradition used the Bible, that it wasn't just, well, it says this here, so you better do it. It was, well, let's have a conversation about this whole part. What can this mean for us if we see God this way?
I mean, rabbinic teaching had sort of twin views of it in a way. It's very relaxed about it and very detailed at the same time. So they believed every word mattered, you know, so they would go into the minutest sort of interpretations of particular words. But equally, they would also spin off stories about it. So there's a whole genre of Jewish theological, almost speculation, called Midrash, where you tell a story around something else, around, say, Abraham or Sarah or these, you know, these other stories. So they kind of elaborate about it. They have enormous, almost fun with the text in that way. Yeah, there is this Jewish thing. I think also that that's a very good point, because if we view the Bible as a particular kind of structure, it will always cause problems for us. If it's a systematized, inerrant, infallible, God dictated thing, you know, that's the thing. Inspired does not mean written by. Actually, the phrase in which is translated in Latin inspirare, theopneustos, God breathed.
Yeah.
So actually, in the Jewish way of looking at it, to have something God breathed is that God brings life to it.
Yes, that's different. That's very different.
It's the valley of the dry bones. You know, it's God bring, and it's Adam, where God breathes his life into Adam. God's life breathes through this book. And so, of course, there's going to be different styles in it. There's going to be a lot of humanity in it, because humans have written it. But God somehow inhabits this and breathes through it. And I think that really handily takes me to the most important point, really, here, is that look, I don't actually have easy answers for this, because even what I've said so far, it relies on quite a lot of, you know, careful digging and Greek knowledge and all this kind of stuff, which is not mine, by the way. I've cribbed it from other people. But, you know, what I do know is that everybody plays whack-a-mole with the Bible.
That's such a great phrase, isn't it?
Yeah.
Biblical whack-a-mole.
We all play whack-a-mole from whatever direction we're coming. And, you know, everybody whacks moles all over the place. We cannot stop whacking our biblical moles, you know.
Yeah.
Because actually, you can argue here, yes, this clearly shows this. But actually, if you look at another use of alethron by Paul in 1 Corinthians 5:5, it refers to handing someone over to punishment, destruction, so they might be saved. So in other words, I don't think he necessarily sees, we can imply from this that he necessarily sees it as eternal punishment. And those who argue that this does say that have to explain that one. So that's they have to play an own version of whack-a-mole with another contradictory statement.
Another
elsewhere.
Set of verses, yeah.
You know, Jesus came, as it says in John's Gospel, so that all might be saved. So what do you do with that? If you believe only some are going to be saved, everybody from whatever theological stance is whacking their moles.
You've got to stop saying that now.
No, I'm going to continue saying it because I love it so much. This, I think, is the real thing. And I don't know what you think about this, about the Bible, is that you have to accept the contradictions.
Yes.
You have to.
Yeah, absolutely.
Did you do systematic theology?
Well, yes, I did. At college. Yes, and I had a big book called Systematic Theology.
Yes.
And that's the great goal of sort of the evangelical training I had, was to be able to make sense of every single passage in the Bible. There were scholars who agreed and disagreed, but we were going to teach the right way that fits in with everything else.
Yes. And how long did your view of systematic theology last? Basically, how the possibility
it
of
was it. Breaking down after 2 years, I would say. Yeah, very firmly. Yeah, of course it was. And this is where I would say, actually, some experience of the divine has to come in and help inform your understanding of the Bible. You know, if you have to ask yourself, who are you, or what are you encountering? How does it seem to you? And where does that fit in the biblical text as well? And how do you support that? You know, I truly don't think I've ever encountered a very angry, wrathful, nasty God. I think I've only ever truly known God to be kind, merciful, loving. And so that helps me with my whack-a-mole. I thought I'd just say it for a change.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Because just as Jesus selectively quoted verses from the Old Testament and left out, you know, the dodgy bits, that sort of shows me that I can too. And it's not just ignore them, but you see the Bible as this kind of search for the divine. You know, like this history. So I personally am not troubled by 1 Thessalonians now the way I would have been years ago. It would have really disturbed me. I'd have to go to scholars and understand that. And how do we make sense of this? And can we really believe this? And, you know, can we still say that God is love if this is really the destiny for so many people? Now I don't do that because now I have a different understanding of the Bible. And I do feel it's a bit more relaxed. And some may say dangerously liberal, and I accept that. But I think we're sort of almost invited to continue this discussion that, like, here's how it was seen. Here's how, you know, generations of people saw the divine. It's an unfolding story. And then we get Jesus on the scene. He's saying, no, reinterpret everything. You've heard this. I'm telling you this. This is how things are. And then the church has gone through various phases, I think, of emphasizing various different things. And we're called to join in with it. How do we see it? How do we understand who God is? Do we really see God as only loving a small handful of people? Or do we see God as giving grace and love and worth and dignity to every single human being on the planet? And if we do, how is that going to affect our behavior?
I mean, I think we're bound to make systems because we're human,
of course,
but the systems are bound to fail for the same reason.
Yes,
because we're human. You know, systematic theology, I mean, really why I wrote the Badly Behaved Bible was why I called it that, was because it refuses to conform to systems. It will not do it. So to come back to Steve's original question, how do I read Paul without getting, depressed or that kind of thing? Is, well, you have to read the good bits, and you're always going to get bits that are going to make you quizzical at the very least, or wonder what on earth he was on, or was he just having a bad day? Because I think Paul had quite a few bad days.
He's grumpy because he was shipwrecked.
Well, he suffered enormously.
Yeah, he did.
And he's that kind of person. He's uncompromising, and they always suffer. And but I don't get the impression that Paul had a systematic theology.
No.
At all.
No, I'm not sure anyone did. Question is, did Jesus?
I don't think he was that interested in it.
No, I don't.
I mean, who am I to speak for Jesus? But, but I just don't think it doesn't come out because... Boy, Jesus quite clearly actually didn't, because he said to the Old Testament passage of the Torah, the law, he said, you've heard this, but I say that. Well, that's ruined that system straight away, hasn't it?
Yeah.
You know, so look, you know, I think you have to accept that there are going to be bits in there you cannot explain. As I said, I'm a universalist. This is a very challenging part of the Bible that isn't very easy to resolve. I'm not sure you can resolve it.
No.
And just a little bit on universalism. I would say universalism is not about everyone escaping punishment either. You know, this is a passage that's clearly about that. Universalism, in my interpretation, is about the punishment not being eternal, or at least the consequences. I'm not sure even punishment's the right term, but you know, God is a God of justice and a God of love. And those two, I think, have to work together. Justice demands consequences for our actions.
Yeah.
And love requires mercy. And so those two have to operate hand in hand.
Okay, that is great. I don't know what I think about judgment anymore, but if I do believe in it, I think I agree with you, although that does sound like a system. You've created a system to deal with that conundrum.
Yes. I'm not saying it's a perfect system. I'm sure it's wrong in many respects, but it's working for me.
I want to ask you a question, though, because I think, you know, we know that biblical literacy among Christians and were church attenders. I mean, I remember a survey, well, it must have been 20 years ago, saying it was at an all-time low. So I think we can assume it's got lower, not, or at least, you know, flattened out. Probably hasn't risen. What would you say to people who don't want to give up on the Bible, who do want to read it and engage with it? And how would you encourage them to return to the Bible, to pick it up and start reading it again?
Partly, I would say, a bit what we'd been discussing, I'd say enjoy the mystery, embrace it, dive into the contradictions. Why not?
Yeah.
You know, you don't have to solve everything. It doesn't have to be a perfect system. You will find things in many stories that make you go, what? I mean, like, I was reading Exodus, you know, the plagues account. And, of course, what's very rarely commented on, for the first three or four plagues, the Egyptian magicians do exactly the same thing. Moses makes the Nile turn to blood, so they do the same thing. Moses creates frogs out of nowhere, and so they do the same thing. In fact, it's only at the fourth one where I heard somebody talk about this the other day, a really good talk. He said, it was only at the gnats, when Moses creates gnats, that the Egyptian magicians can't do that.
Really? Gnats is too much. Frogs so
yeah, funny. Yeah. I mean, you'd have thought frogs. Yeah, really. You'd have thought if you could do frogs, yeah. You could do gnats. But at that point, they couldn't do it. But I love that. You see, I love the fact that, that these things are in the Bible. You can enjoy that. You don't have to think the whole thing is destroyed because there's mystery in there. I think it's actually rather wonderful. So do that. If that doesn't work for you, really find the bits that really do resonate with you and spend time with them.
Yeah.
You know, you don't have to go near 2 Thessalonians ever again if you don't want to.
Well, there you go. I completely agree with you. And I think in part that has been solved by understanding that God is bigger than but the God isn't contained in the Bible, that actually you can know God outside of that, and that this is a record of our best thinking about it. But it isn't God itself. It is not Father, Son and Holy Bible.
No.
It's Father, Son and Holy Spirit. And we've got to come to terms with that.
But that thing about dwelling with the Bible, I would still encourage people to go there, because I think you've talked about this in the past, about taking a verse, living with it for a month, for two months.
For a year.
You know, just learn it, stay with it. That's a great way of reading the Bible. Or a story, you know, take a parable or a story that particularly resonates with you and really, you know, explore it until you get the most out of it. You don't have to go anywhere near the rest of it if you don't want to. I'm sure you will, but, you know, I think there are various ways to engage with it without actually having that feeling of dread that Steve talked about.
No, exactly. Instead of dwelling on a kind of wrathful verse, why not, therefore, as God's chosen people, holy and dearly loved, clothe yourselves with compassion, kindness, humility, gentleness and patience. There's a good one.
Amen.
Spend a year with that one.
Yeah.
Great. Well, thank you. And thank you for all your work you've done in the Badly Behaved Bible, which I know anyone who's never heard of it will go and buy now.
Thank you very much. Yes. It's all borrowed from other writers, but, you know, the innuendo jokes are my own. I'm proud of those.
Of course they are.
Well, anyway, I feel we should stop whacking our moles now and talking of innuendo jokes. And and we should finish this podcast. Thank you very much for listening, as ever.
Yes, indeed.
Thank you for those who write in. If you do wish to write in with feedback or questions or comments, send your email to
joe@midfaithcrisis.org.
Thank you to everyone who gives to the podcast. That's absolutely wonderful. Everyone who recommends it to other people, that's how this grows. And we're very grateful. And we will be back with you next week. But Joe, perhaps you have a blessing for us before
we go. I do have a blessing for the weary Bible reader.
Excellent.
So this is to encourage you all. May you be blessed with patience and grace as you approach the sacred pages. When the words feel heavy, may you sense the whisper of God's love, drawing you deeper. When the passages confuse or challenge you, may you find the courage to wrestle with them, trusting that even the struggle is holy. May your mind be open to fresh insights and your heart be soft to the Spirit's leading. May the stories of ancient times speak into your present, and may the promises of hope and life take root in your soul. Above all, may you know that you are not alone. The author walks with you, guiding you, loving you through every word and every silence.